Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. About 10% of students enrolled in higher education in America attend for-profit colleges. But those students account for nearly half of the defaults on federal student loans. And the complaints just start there. Congress, the Justice Department, and many states across the country have stepped in. This hour On Point, we'll talk with a muckraking journalist who enrolled at a for-profit university and ask what he found. Joining me first today from Washington is Goldie Blumenstick, senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education. She's been closely following the growth in for-profit higher ed and the red flags that have been raised. Goldie, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
We're going to talk in just a minute with a Harper's Magazine reporter who himself enrolled and hear about his experience. But you've been following this for a long time. Give us a little bit of the arc of this, Goldie. I mean, there was a long period where for-profit higher ed just boomed and didn't have many problems, at least not the kind they're having now. It was a real rocket for a while, Goldie.
Yeah, it was. And actually, this is a pretty interesting moment to take a look at this industry because we're sort of hit a turning point. The industry has really been around for decades, but it really took off in the mid-90s. And basically, from the mid-90s till about a year ago, it grew six times faster probably than all of higher education.
Wow. So
that's, you said about 10 or 11% of the students. That's 2.2 million students.
Mm-hmm.
It's a $28 billion industry. And that sounds like a big number. It's about 6% of all of the higher education industry. Another telling number is the number of, it accounts for about a quarter of all the Pell Grant money that goes to higher education, though. That's the money that goes. That's for low-income students. And so that number has been growing also, and that's one of the reasons we're seeing, I think, growing attention to the sector from Congress and primarily Congress and the Education Department.
Give us a sense of that attention. It's been very harsh, a bright light focus here. What have the concerns been?
The concerns have been primarily about whether the schools are doing what they're supposed to be doing, whether they're training students for successful careers in the fields of study that they're undertaking. There's the rising default rate levels have alarmed some members of Congress and the Education Department, and there's also been a lot of discussion about some of the recruiting tactics at the schools, concerns that perhaps some of the government regulations had too many loopholes that allowed schools to do a lot of high-pressure recruiting to get those students. And that's we've just sort of come to the end of a period of about 18 months, I would say, of intense scrutiny from Congress, from the Education Department, from the courts that have been sort of focused heavily on this industry. And it concluded in June at a moment with some new regulations that came down on the industry, which, as you might expect, have since been challenged in court already. So this is not a story that's over, but it's kind of we're at a moment of pause in the industry while these new regulations start to kick in.
And 10 states around the country are on their guard here and, going after one way or another for-profit higher ed. What kind of charges or constraints are they looking to bring?
The state inquiries are kind of varied, actually. There's a lawsuit that you may be referring to involving one of the companies that the Justice Department is pursuing on behalf of one and several of the states that's involving Education Management Corporation. There are a bunch of attorney generals, perhaps as many as 21, led by the attorney general in Kentucky, Jack Conway, who are sort of a little task force right now, and they're investigating various different claims and concerns about primarily consumer issues about recruiting at the colleges, whether the colleges are lying about their placement rates, whether the colleges are providing adequate consumer information to prospective students. And then there's also just kind of a lot of efforts in state legislatures. They've had a number of states, including today I saw something in Maryland where there's discussions about getting increased regulation coming out of the state legislatures.
And a real impact here between sort of this critical public discussion and these moves. I mean, we're seeing, I'm reading in the Wall Street Journal, enrollment down in some cases more than 45% in recent months. That's pretty amazing. Shares down. These are private companies, many of them privately traded. Corinthian Colleges, this was August, but it was down 72%, something like that back then. I mean, they are taking a hit.
They're taking a very big hit, and a lot of them are trying to respond. I don't know if you saw this summer, there was also this effort by several different industry groups coming out with these what they're calling codes of conduct. This is an effort by the industry to self-regulate. Some might say it's trying to preempt some of the regulations by, you know, having them come up with some of the codes of their own. And to some degree, some of these self-regulations are part of what's slowing the growth. Some of the biggest companies have instituted free orientation programs. Kaplan and the University of Phoenix do that. And in fact, their enrollments have suffered as a result of that. Students are signing up, taking the free orientation program and saying, you know, not for me, stepping out.
And reined in some of what's been described as boiler room recruiting tactics, really hardcore recruiting.
It's very, some of the companies have also made an effort, they say at least, to change the recruiting tactics. It's pretty hard to get in there. These are still giant marketing efforts to do recruiting of students. And, you know, places have as many as 6,000. University of Phoenix has something like 6,000 recruiters and academic counselors who work on this. There are other companies, frankly. There's one called American Public University that I think has 64 or something like that. They don't use that model. They use a different kind of a model to recruit students. So it doesn't have to be a high-pressure sales model, and it doesn't have to be a numbers game, but a lot of the companies still use the numbers game.
But a real change in climate around for-profit higher education. We're going to dive on in and look at that. Goldie Blumenstick with the Chronicle of Higher Education, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Here's an ad for the biggest of the big, the University of Phoenix.
One university understands how you live today and where you want to go tomorrow. University of Phoenix, thinking ahead.
The ads are all over if you've been in there. And, well, join us. Tell us what experience you've had. 800-423-8255. Joining me right now from Philadelphia is Chris Beha, associate editor at Harper's Magazine. He's been there. He enrolled at the University of Phoenix and wrote about his experience in the October issue of Harper's. The article is titled Leveling the Field, What I Learned from For-Profit Education. Chris Beha, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Where did you sign up? What did you sign up for?
I enrolled in the Jersey City campus. I'm based in New York, and that was the closest campus. And when I went in to enroll, I told them that I had no previous college experience. And so I went first through the orientation that Goldie just mentioned that is a recent addition to their program. And then I started in their first year sequence, which is another recent addition. They have particularly bad graduation numbers for students who come in with no previous college experience. It's actually less than 1 in 10 of those students wind up getting a degree within 6 years. And in an effort at some self-reform, they have instituted this first-year sequence for those students that is going to prepare them to do college work.
Say that again and clarify, only 1 in 10 who... What?
At the time, it was about 7%, a 7% graduation rate for students who are coming in, because they get a lot of transfer students or students who have accrued credits elsewhere.
Right.
But if you take a student who's coming in as a freshman with no previous college experience, 7% of those students are going to wind up with a degree.
Now, how does that compare with other not-for-profit universities in this country?
It's very low compared, certainly, to private four-year colleges. It's quite low compared to public four-year colleges as well. The one type of college that has similarly low graduation numbers are public two-year colleges, community colleges, and junior colleges, which also happen to be open enrollment, as Phoenix and virtually all of the for-profits are.
And this 7% number, is that Phoenix or all for-profits?
That's Phoenix in particular, yeah.
Tell us, this is such an interesting report here, and I was interested by who you found there as your classmates, Chris, when you enrolled in the University of Phoenix. You know, look to your left, look to your right, look around. Give us a sort of profile of who was using this for-profit education opportunity.
Sure. So there were 20 students in my class, and they ranged from students who were more or less right out of high school, who were kind of traditional college freshman age students, to students in their 40s, working parents. They were generally lower income. The vast majority were black or Hispanic. And they a lot of them had been, you know, out of the classroom for a long time.
Why were they here instead of at a public college or community college or private university? Why the for-profit stream?
Well, I think there's two answers to that question. The first, if you want to give places like Phoenix some credit, is they design their schedule in a way that is friendly to working students. So you take one course at a time for 5 weeks sort of intensively rather than a semester system, and it allows you to go in and out over time and to manage your course load. The other answer is just that Phoenix aggressively recruited them, which the our public universities are largely oversubscribed. A lot of local community colleges, there are laws on the books that if you say in New York City, where I'm from, if you graduate from a high school in New York City, you're guaranteed a place in a local community college.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But these places are oversubscribed. They're not going out and looking for these students, and Phoenix does.
We're going to look at exactly what that experience was. Christopher Beja went there for Harper's Magazine. He writes about it in the current issue. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about for-profit higher education and charges that it has been failing some students, maybe ripping off the government is the kind of the suggestion in Christopher Beja's report, big report in Harper's Magazine. He enrolled, and he's come out to tell the story of what he found. Here's a marketing video from DeVry University, one of the big ones.
One of the appealing things to me also was the fact that I would be able to work at my own pace.
They can take programs on campus. They can take programs in centers. They can take programs online. They can take a mix of all of those. No other university offers that flexibility.
Because it fits in my program, doing working a 9-to-5 job and then coming home and doing homework really worked out well for me.
Sounds great and good where it's really worked out well. Terrific. But what about those who aren't making it through and those who do and then don't get a job? There's been a lot of criticism lately. Here was Democratic Iowa Senator Tom Harkin has been leading congressional hearings on for-profit colleges. Here he was back in June.
Would you make loans to any entity that you knew 50% of them would never pay it back? While the school knows these loans are a terrible investment, the student has no idea they are more likely to wind up with ruined credit than a college degree and a good job.
Christopher Behad, tell us about the experience. Who was teaching you? What was it like? What were you being taught?
So our teacher, which Phoenix actually calls facilitators rather than professors, which gets at the heart of their model, had a PhD and was generally qualified, I think, to be a university-level instructor. But she had very little control over the curriculum that we were being taught.
And interestingly, her PhD was from the University of Phoenix.
Right, yes.
So okay. Yeah. I mean, yes, they hired her.
So the work that we did was generally submitted online, and our tests were graded through a central online grading system.
Is that a problem?
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be a problem, but in our case, there was sometimes a sense that the instructor didn't have full command of the material because the instructor had not really participated in putting the material together.
Okay.
That work is done by a central curriculum committee in Phoenix.
But that hardly sounds like a fatal flaw necessarily. If they can offer convenience and people can study where they like, you get your papers graded pretty quickly, I guess, if it goes central that way.
Sure. What I would say, as far as a fatal flaw goes, there were 20 people in my initial class, and within a couple of months, each class is 5 weeks. So within three of those 5 week sessions, so less than a 4-course semester, it was down to 5 people. So right off the bat, within a semester, you have lost 15 out of those 20. And all of those people not only were government Pell Grants being spent, paid to Phoenix for their enrollment, they were all taking on loans that are non-dischargeable loans that are going to continue to follow them around. And so their effort to put themselves in a better position through education, and these were all very hardworking, dedicated people who wound up in the classroom because they wanted to improve their economic situation. The net result of that effort was that they were in worse position. They had no degree. They had credits that were going to be hard to transfer to another university, and they had loans that they needed to pay off.
I was struck by what was clearly driving so many people here was that, I mean, they wanted a good economic life. They had dreams. They got the message that you need a college degree in this country to make those work, and this looked like maybe the only option available to them. So here they come with those dreams, those hopes, and even the readiness to take on debt to do it. I mean, they are feeling driven into these schools, or driven to look for something to put them ahead in this very tough job market, Chris.
Absolutely. And when you say they got the message, you know, it's that message that I question. And it's not just Phoenix recruiters calling them up who are giving them that message. It's the Obama administration that, you know, a lot of the higher education rhetoric is about how you simply can't compete in this economy without a degree, how we need to return to the world's lead in percentage of adults with college degrees. On the local sort of cultural level, you are told that your ticket to the middle class is a college degree. The rhetoric is very similar, actually, to rhetoric about home ownership a decade ago, which is that, you know, if you want to be a member in good standing of our society, you need to own your own home. And now they're saying if you want to be a member in good standing of our society, you need to have a bachelor's degree.
I mean, it can sound just like rhetoric, but if you need a job, and those are the requirements in a lot of places, you can understand why people are really looking hard to get that. I was struck on the one hand, you've got for-profit institutions that have made a lot of money. I mean, the founder of the University of Phoenix, you remind us, spent something like $20 million to genetically clone his dog.
Yes.
We're talking big money. On the other hand, a lot of the growth here, as you describe it, Chris, is tied to a government message, President Obama's
Absolutely.
Message, and to government money much more deeply than I'd really taken on board. First, the message and President Obama's goal, you say, when he says we will lead the world in the percentage of university graduates by the year 2020, you sort of lay that out as a formula that means we will drive a lot of people into for-profit higher ed.
Yeah, I mean, what Phoenix will tell you is we can't achieve our higher education goals without places like Phoenix. And they're absolutely right. But the truth is that those goals don't make particular sense. And the fact that the only way to achieve them is to give billions of dollars to places like Phoenix so they can graduate 1 out of 10 students it suggests that those goals don't make a lot of sense.
So you're laying it on the president. I mean, it's his goal, the 2020 goal.
Yes. And I mean, not just the president. It's left, right, center. Everyone sort of agrees that access to higher education is the best way to solve America's inequality problem. And it just doesn't seem to be so. A simple logic would dictate that you cannot confer the marginal benefits of a college degree on everybody.
Why not? If we're competing with the whole world, it's not against fellow Americans, right? It's an advantage. It's a globalist economy advantage that I guess we're supposed to be talking about here.
Sure, but our big problem right now in terms of unemployment, a lot of it does seem to be domestic, you know, people competing with each other. And the fact that we have a domestic inequality problem that, you know, the rhetoric of Occupy Wall Street right now, the 99% versus the 1%, you know, that's a domestic issue, that there are winners and losers, and the few winners get a lot. And the many losers get not very much.
40% of American adults have college degrees today. Russia has the world's highest rate at 54%. President Obama says we're going to be number one. That means producing an additional 40 million college graduates over the next decade. Those numbers don't add up without for-profit higher education. But Christopher Beha writes in Harper's, enrolling at for-profit colleges turns out to be a terrible deal for most students. quoting you here. And you go on, almost three-fifths drop out without a degree within a year. Virtually all take on debt to help pay for their education. They default on their loans at about twice the rate of students at public colleges and universities, three times the rate of students at private ones. Then you write, those who graduate often wind up in low-paying jobs doing tasks with minimal connection to their degrees. Now, I should say, in this economy, there are a lot of public and private, you know, nonprofit grads who face that circumstance. But what I hadn't fallen to was how this comes back to federal money. Paint that picture for us, Chris, how that is really riding behind this whole industry.
Goldie mentioned that it's about a $28 billion industry. About $25 billion of that comes from federal money. They get a quarter of all Pell Grants, as was mentioned, mm-hmm. and roughly the same percentage of subsidized student loans. So what that means is the federal government is guaranteeing the student loans. Phoenix and other for-profits get the tuition payments either directly from the federal government or from some lender for whom the federal government is providing a guarantee. They get that money no matter what happens. That money is in Phoenix, in the bank for Phoenix. And then the students are paying those loans back to the federal government or to the lender. And then those are non-dischargeable, as I said, so you can't go into bankruptcy to get out of them. And the federal government will garnish, you know, welfare payments or Social Security.
So when there's a default, what happens? Does that mean it's the tax? It just goes on the national debt or it's just garnished? Or
Eventually, over time, the government will recover that money from the student. But short term, when there's a default, yes, it is the taxpayer who's picking up the bill.
So when they're recruiting, they know that there's government money there, whatever the dropout rate may be, and they're going hard after that. David Petraeus's wife, Holly Petraeus, has spoken out very prominently and recently about them going very hard, in particular after military personnel and their families. Why would that be such a big target, Chris?
Well, we've got a post 9/11 GI Bill where there is a lot of federal education money that is particularly directed to veterans who have served in Iraq or Afghanistan. And Phoenix and their ilk, they're smart companies when it comes to generating a profit. They're going to go where the money is. And so the money is in grants for lower-income students and in veterans.
And they need some of those veterans in there because they can't have all Title IX money. David Petraeus's, again, wife Holly writes, this was in the New York Times in September, this gives for-profit colleges an incentive to see service members as nothing more than dollar signs in uniform. On the other hand, here's a demand and people trying to figure out some way to deal with it. Christopher Beha is with us from Harper's Magazine. Chris, let's bring our listeners in, see what their experience is. Lamar in Norfolk, Virginia. Lamar, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
How you doing, Tom?
All right.
I tried to get into one of these colleges. Well, I went to a recruiter, and it felt more like I was being pushed to buy a used car or something. Needless to say, I'm starting to enroll in the local community college and get certification. And for about a quarter of the price, I'm about to get Cisco certification and be all right without having to accrue all that debt. But my point was, mm-hmm. I mean, the feeling that I got in that place when I was talking to the recruiter was just like straight used car salesman. And the pressure was ridiculous.
It put you off, but some people go for that and they go right in, Lamar.
Yeah, but I have previous college experience too, so I know what it's supposed to feel like. And,
right.
And the normal colleges, it felt like they was trying to help me. And when I was talking to the guy, it felt more like he was trying to help himself to a commission.
Lamar, I appreciate your call, and I wish you good luck, Christopher. This the commission on enrollments has I think been dropped. Right, that was the issue. I guess that was straight up illegal.
Sure. You could not have compensation tied entirely to your recruitment numbers. And how that law was enforced changed between the Bush administration and the Obama administration, and there was some ambiguity to it. But this current lawsuit with the Education Management Corporation has to do with that recruiting. And the president of that company was formerly the head of Phoenix. And during his tenure at Phoenix was involved in very similar practices, and they settled a lawsuit where they admitted no wrongdoing, but they did agree to a settlement, and that was over these recruiting practices.
We're looking.
I'd like to say another thing about this analogy with used cars. You know, it sounds like Lamar, a caller, is a fairly discerning consumer, which not all of the people who wind up being recruited by a place like Phoenix are. But what a lot of these students don't realize is that they are consumers who have tens of thousands of dollars to spend. It doesn't happen
because
of their money.
Right. It's federal money.
They are, yeah, but probably, you know, these are lower income people who have never been in a position where they have that kind of money to spend on a big ticket item. You know, it's much more like buying, in terms of the money you're putting out, buying a new car than a used car. And Phoenix, you know, it treats them accordingly in terms of trying to market to them and recruit them and get their dollars. And often the students themselves, it doesn't occur to them that they have some real buying power and that they can be sort of discerning about some of the choices they make.
Jim's calling from Palm City, Florida. Jim, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. I called the University of Phoenix a while ago, and I just wanted to share my experience with you. Just to give you some background, I'm in my 40s. I've got two screaming kids, and I also am very well established in my career. I've got an income that's very healthy. But I felt that what I needed to was just to gain knowledge of the specific software programming language just to put in my portfolio skills.
Right. How'd it work out?
Well, I went through was the recruiter experience thus far. From my standpoint, I guess I could go to Barnes and Nobles and buy a book on this language and go through it page by page. But I know myself well enough that I don't have the discipline to do that on my own. So that's why I gave them a call. And my experience with the recruiter was great. He pointed me to the right course material on the website. I was able to review the course material, the course criteria. He set expectations for what the experience was going to be, what the timelines were going to be, and so on and so forth.
But you're still headed in, Jim. I hope we can talk once you've made it in there and see what experience you actually have with it. I'd love to hear one more. Jessica in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jessica, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. We've just got a minute. What's your story, Jessica?
I went to Everest, which is one of the Corinthian colleges, and it was the most horrible experience I've ever had.
Why?
The recruitment was really intense, and the recruiter actually had the audacity to tell me that muscular therapists would have the possibility of making up to $1 million a year.
Wow.
Which I knew was absurd, but I figured if they were saying that, then maybe it was like $50,000 a year.
How did you come out? Did you come out with a job? Did you come out with debt? Both? What?
I've definitely come out with debt and no jobs. I started my own business for a while, which did not end up going well.
So what grade do you give your experience in that particular case?
It's the experience overall with for-profit colleges.
Yes.
Absolutely a failing grade.
Failing grade. Jessica, I'm sorry for that, and I hope it ends up working out well for you. Appreciate your call. Christopher Beha is with us from Harper's Magazine. He's been inside the for-profit higher education world. We're going to come back and hear from a supporter who says, hey, look, we need this. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about for-profit higher education charges, that it's failing its students, maybe ripping off the government. Christopher Beha, please stand by in Philadelphia. We're joined right now from Albany, New York, by Kevin Kinzer. He's professor in the Department of Educational Administration and Policy Studies at the University of Albany, State University of New York. He's author of From Main Street to Wall Street, The Transformation of For-Profit Higher Education. Kevin Kinzer, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
So I know you see a role for these. You've called them a vital part of our education universe, and I want to understand that. But let me just put to you, we've talked with a number of people about this, including some who, you know, do background research for investors. Wow, we talked to one yesterday who just, the sort of litany of complaints was very sharp. She said they victimize the very people who want to be the first in their family to have a college education. Said this is subprime goes to college. I mean, they spend a fortune on lobbying. It's worked. I've never heard someone talk positively about this industry who hasn't been paid. You know, there's very tough view out there right now, Kevin. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, well, I mean, just to be clear, you know, I'm not someone who gets paid by the industry at all. I'm a faculty member.
Great.
I study it as part of my research. And also, I mean, I have my own criticisms about the sector as well, and many of the points that you made are I think, on target. But I think such a broad-brushed criticism misses a larger point, in particular a distinction between criticizing the for-profits for their business model versus their academic model. And I think that's the distinction that we need to keep clear. Their business model is based on enrollment, and it's open to abuse and some of the challenges that have been put forward. But from an academic perspective, I think that they are accredited by the same agencies that accredit any other college or university that you know of. And from the programs that they offer, I don't see any reason to completely dismiss the entire academic efforts of all for-profits based on the experience that a few people have had.
Why do you think the growth has been so enormous? Is it? I mean, the suggestion here is that it's grown so much because there's so much government money sitting there, and it's a kind of, scam is a harsh word, and there are a lot of distinctions to be made here, but when you look at the dropout rate, that's what some people are suggesting.
Well, yeah, this is what I'm saying about their business model. Their mm-hmm. business model is based on enrollment. Actually, in reality, it's based on new enrollment. They have to, in order to grow at the rates that we saw over the past 5 years or so, they had to enroll an enormous number of new students every single term, every single quarter, in order to make up for the students who would leave their program without a degree or graduate.
It's kind of hard to go straight to the academic model when that one has so much fall off. On the other hand,
right.
Maybe they're trying to deal with the student populations that are not easily served and maybe not always so well prepared.
Well, I mean, they may not be well prepared, but we have a policy in the United States, and we've had for the past 3 decades, that says that college education is something that should be available to everybody, and that money shouldn't be a barrier to it, and that we have a diverse range of institutions that are open to students from all different kinds of backgrounds. And the for-profits, from an academic model, have tapped into that and have designed academic programs that in large measure target the very adult the adult students, the working students that need these kinds of options in order to have access to post-secondary education.
Is there something that public and private not-for-profits are simply not doing? Are they failing to sort of be there in such a way that they could deal with these students?
Well, I wouldn't put it in that sort of dichotomy. I think the things that the for-profits are doing is targeting the students and designing the institutional program for the students, designing the academics so that it's convenient for the students, that addresses them where they're at, that puts them into curriculum that are designed explicitly to get a job. Those sorts of things are quite attractive. We mentioned earlier the notion of targeting military. Many of these programs and colleges have very explicitly designed their programs to be attractive to the military, something that many traditional colleges have not done.
But, I mean, here you have General Petraeus' wife, Holly, saying, come on, they're exploiting these people. They're pouncing on them, whether they can. I mean, she goes back to this, there was a frontline program about a recruiter signing up Marines with serious brain injuries. That hardly sounds like, they didn't even know what classes they were taking.
Oh, no, there's no way to defend that sort of behavior, of course. And, you know, we get into debates about whether this is targeting a few bad apples, if there are people who are operating outside the boundaries of activity. But most of the institutions are actually operated with propriety and with care. You know, I've talked with a lot of people.
That's a very broad statement in itself. With these dropout rates, how can you say most are with propriety and care? Aren't those quite enormous?
Well, the dropout rates are kind of hard to get a handle around. When you talk about graduation rates, the only official statistic we have is from the Department of Education, and that only counts those students that are first-time, full-time students enrolling in a program of study. That doesn't include the vast majority of students that are enrolling in those programs. That said, they are not graduating the numbers of students that represent the growth in enrollment that they have. So in other words, they're growing in enrollment much faster than they're increasing their graduation. So there is some question, obviously, about the students that are graduating. But I guess the issue that I have is to make a distinction between, is their academic program something that is worthwhile versus the business model that they have of how they recruit students. We can correct and adjust business model. We can put incentives in there to connect the business model to appropriate outcomes. And I think that's what a lot of the regulatory efforts have been doing over the past year and a half or so, to really get a handle to make the business model actually have to respond to the quite innovative academic model that many of these institutions have, and connect an outcome for the education to the enrollment benefit that the investors get.
Chris Beha, it's hard to look beyond that business model sometime when you see some of the problems in the numbers, but let's do it for a moment. Now, I mean, you were only there for a limited time. There's a lot you didn't do, but what about the academic sort of substance of this? What's your sense of it from having been inside and seen it and watched it? Can we hold that up and say, look, yeah, they got all kinds of problems around here, but if you finally get in there and get in the class, this is worthwhile. This is a real education.
Well, I think it's probably likely that if you make it through to the second and third year, you're doing work at a place like Phoenix that's comparable to what goes on at a lot of nonprofit, private or public universities. In the first year course that I was taking, we were working on skills like time management and goal setting and skills that one needs to succeed as a college student, but not skills that one would typically think you would get college credit for studying. And that has to do with remediation, basically. The truth is that throughout the country, America's high schools are producing high school graduates who are not actually ready to do serious college work, and that's certainly not Phoenix's fault. And if you do want to have if you want to offer all of these people access, then there's going to be some remediation to do. The difference is that in the public university landscape, you don't get course credit for doing remedial work, whereas a place like Phoenix is not going to get its students to pay if it's not giving them credit toward their degree for the work.
A lot of response online here. Deacon says the last thing we need in a society rife with unemployment is an industry providing unusable degrees to the young for profit. I don't know. Steve on Facebook says, here's an idea. Require for-profit schools to guarantee the student loans. They either have to give a quality education that would lead to good repayment rates or give up the government cash cow. Then Dar writes, shouldn't these colleges be called for-more-profit colleges? And he says, look around at the public and private universities, all the money they're pouring into athletics and so on looks kind of for-profit in itself. And Jeff says it's true. The line is getting pretty blurred. Linda's calling from Rutland, Massachusetts. Hi, Linda. You're on the air. What's your experience?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have an interesting perspective because I am both a graduate of an online law school,
okay,
as well as I now teach in a health science associate degree program, as well as at two different settings. So I was able to use my law degree that I got online.
Good for you.
For teaching. But what I want folks to understand is that there's an expectation, perhaps, that when you get your degree through some of these online programs that, oh, it's easy, and we can just, jump in and we'll get our classes and we don't really have to do a lot of work. But in fact, these classes are really hard for many, many students. And I spend a lot of time not just teaching the core material that needs to be taught, but also teaching those remediation skills, because so many folks join in and they don't have the skill to actually participate in the classroom. And then what we also see is that students don't have a realistic expectation of the time that it's going to take
mm-hmm.
to be in that online classroom.
So on balance, how do you think about the business on balance then, Linda? When you hear somebody saying, I've got one here, they're not in the business of education, they're in the business of churning loans. How do you look at it?
It is a business. It is for profit. But the product is an education. And I actually work with curriculum directors to make sure that our course revisions are appropriate and up to date, so that students are getting the best and the latest information, particularly in the healthcare field where things are changing constantly. So I know I work very hard to make sure that there is an education and that these students are walking away with something tangible that they can use in the field.
But you've got to teach whoever shows up, and it's not necessarily a high bar.
That's right. They come in at all different skill levels, and some need perhaps to be in a special education setting more so than in that online classroom. And others, you know, just are really good, really motivated, working in the industry already, and do a good job, and now they have the piece of paper to say they can do this.
Yeah, and good for them, and maybe some good skills right along with it. Linda, I appreciate your call. One more. Josh in Reading, Massachusetts. Josh, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you know?
Well, I wanted to share my experience, and I really have enjoyed this conversation. I'm a recent MBA grad from the University of Phoenix. I got my degree in June of last year, and I had really just a phenomenal experience. And most of this conversation has centered around the undergraduate level, and I can't really speak to that because I was fortunate. I came from a traditional 4-year undergraduate program.
Why did you choose to do a for-profit MBA? Why Phoenix, Josh?
Well, two reasons. The first is, the main reason is that they had a program that's designed, it's called the FlexNet program. And what that does is that combines both the on-ground learning module as well as the online virtual classroom, which was ideal for me because at the time in my career I was traveling excessively and I could not commit to doing an on-ground traditional program because my schedule wouldn't allow, and I did not want to do an all-online version because I wanted the on-ground classroom experience.
Josh, are employers respecting your for-profit MBA?
Well, I'm going to tell you, halfway through the program, I became a casualty of the economy and I lost my job. I had a senior-level sales position.
Sorry.
And I lost my job in January of 2010. Prior to that, I was going to school on a part-time basis, and I converted over into a full-time from January of last year till when I got my degree in June. And I can tell you unequivocally that my MBA program was the differentiator in the job that I have now, which I landed about 4 months ago. And it's actually the highest job that I've ever had, and I know for a fact that the MBA program that I the degree that I had was a big influencer in that decision of me getting hired.
So there's a story with a good ending out of this realm, and we appreciate hearing it, Josh. Thanks for your call. We're talking about for-profit higher education. Let me get one more right here. Gary in Charleston, South Carolina. Gary, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a retired senior executive from a 2-year public community college system.
Okay.
And I've been an adjunct instructor in 3 or 4 different for-profit institutions. I think your guest, especially Chris, may be overlooking the key point, which is the linkage between federal dollars and the level of tuition, which is what causes many of these institutions to exist.
Lay that out for us, Gary. What do you mean?
For example, if a student in a town goes to a local 2-year community college to get an associate degree in a allied health program, rad tech, nursing, something like that, they get one level of Pell Grant and subsidized loans.
Mm-hmm.
If they go right across town to a for-profit institution that charges 4 times the tuition, they can get 4 times the amount of federal money and qualify for the loans because the tuition is higher because the money is linked. There's not a national model that would say, here's the amount of federal money you can get for a 2-year associate degree nursing or a 2-year culinary arts.
So jack up the tuition, Gary, and the federal money just follows right along. If you've got higher tuition, you get more money. That is
correct, and I think this is the key to the whole issue, is that these private institutions have learned, we can charge considerably more money because the more we charge, the more money we get from the feds.
Gary, I appreciate your call. Kevin Kinzer, that can sound like a racket.
Yeah, no, the stories that you hear are pretty disturbing when you get to those kinds of details. But I guess I just want to make sure that we're clear. I mean, some of the outcomes that these programs have are quite valuable. We've talked before about whether we want to have a system in this country where students, where we want to have more college graduates than any other country. And if that's the kind of policy that we have, then obviously we have to have a lot of different options for people to go. But that's not the only purpose of these institutions. We've been talking a lot about undergraduate degrees. There's obviously a large number of graduate degrees that are awarded, but more significantly are the non-degree credentials that these institutions award. And that's really the market where they are most substantial, where we need them the most. Obama's 2020 plan is not just about getting degrees. It's actually about getting people with a year or more of post-secondary education. And getting those kinds of credentials, 1 and 2 year credentials that aren't degrees, are the kinds of traditional focus that for-profits have had, and that in many ways they still succeed at. And it's just, if I could make one more point also, the focus on the University of Phoenix is also somewhat inappropriate. It's a really unusual for-profit institution.
It's the biggest one.
It's by far the biggest one. It's also unusual in the way that it awards primarily only degrees, and most for-profit institutions award a large number of non-degree certificates, which obviously are going to be targeting a different kind of population. So I don't think that we should be painting that broad of a brush across all institutions of higher, all for-profit institutions.
Chris Beha, where do you come down here? Do we have a boondoggle on the federal dime, despite the individual success stories, or something else, Chris?
Well, I quite agree with Kevin, actually, that we need more 1 and 2 year post-secondary certificate programs. But right now, the federal dollars are going towards 2 and 4 year degrees, and these places are growing by capturing those dollars.
And they're going there in great big volume. Christopher Beha with Harper's Magazine, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Kevin Kinzer in Albany, thanks so much for joining us.
Appreciate it.
Listeners, good luck on whatever path you're on. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.